It wasn't enough to set us up. You had to coach him. You had to turn him into you. Claudia said quietly, Rosie, it wasn't Jean's. Jean put a hand on Claudia's shoulder and she stopped. No, it wasn't, he said. Who asked him to change? Who said that he'd be perfect for her if he was different? Rosie was now looking very upset. All of my friends, except Dave the baseball fan, were fighting. This was terrible. I wanted to roll the story back to New York and make better decisions, but it was impossible. Nothing would change the fault in my brain that made me unacceptable. Jean hadn't stopped. Do you have any idea what he did for you? Take a look in his office sometime. He was presumably referring to my schedule and the large number of Rosie project activities. Rosie walked out of the restaurant. Jean turned to Claudia. Sorry I interrupted you. Someone had to say it, said Claudia. She looked at Rosie, who was already some distance down the street. I think I coached the wrong person. Jean and Claudia offered me a lift home, but I did not want to continue the conversation. I started walking, then accelerated to a jog. It made sense to get home before it rained. It also made sense to exercise hard and put the restaurant behind me as quickly as possible. The new shoes were workable, but the coat and tie were uncomfortable, even on a cold night. I pulled off the jacket, the item that had made me temporarily acceptable in a world to which I did not belong, and threw it in a rubbish bin. The tie followed. On an impulse, I retrieved the Daphne from the jacket and carried it in my hand for the remainder of the journey. There was rain in the air, and my face was wet as I reached the safety of my apartment. Chapter 34. We had not finished the wine at the restaurant. I decided to compensate for the resulting alcohol deficit and poured a tumbler of tequila. I turned on the television screen and computer and fast-forwarded Casablanca for one last try. I watched as Humphrey Bogart's character used beans as a metaphor for the relative unimportance in the wider world of his relationship with Ingrid Bergman's character, and chose logic and decency ahead of his selfish emotional desires. The quandary and resulting decision made for an engrossing film. But this was not what people cried about. They were in love and could never be together. I repeated this statement to myself, trying to force an emotional reaction. I couldn't. I didn't care. I had enough problems of my own. The doorbell buzzed, and I immediately thought Rosie. But when I pushed the CCTV button, it was Claudia's face that appeared. Don, are you okay? She said. Can we come up? It's too late. Claudia sounded panicked. What have you done, Don? It's 10:31, I said. Too late for visitors. Are you okay? Said Claudia again. I'm fine. The experience has been highly useful. New social skills. And final resolution of the wife problem. Clear evidence that I'm incompatible with women. Jean's face appeared on the screen. Don, can we come up for a drink? Alcohol would be a bad idea. I still had a half glass of tequila in my hand. I was telling a polite lie to avoid social contact. I turned off the intercom. The message light on my home phone was flashing. It was my parents and brother wishing me a happy birthday. I had already spoken to my mother 2 days earlier when she made her regular Sunday evening call. These past 3 weeks I had been attempting to provide some news in return, but had not mentioned Rosie. They were utilizing the speakerphone function and collectively sang the birthday song, or at least my mother did, strongly encouraging my other two relatives to participate. "Ring back if you're home before 10:30, my mother said. It was 10:38, but I decided not to be pedantic. "It's 10:39, said my mother. "I'm surprised you rang back." Clearly she had expected me to be pedantic, which was reasonable given my history, but she sounded pleased. "Hey," said my brother, "Gary Parkinson's sister saw you on Facebook. Who's the redhead?" "Just a girl I was dating." "Pull the other leg," said my brother. The words had sounded strange to me too, but I had not been joking. "I'm not seeing her anymore." "I thought you might say that," he laughed. My mother interrupted. "Stop it, Trevor. Donald, you didn't tell us you were seeing someone. You know you're always welcome, Mum. He was having a land of you, said my brother. I said my mother, that any time you want to bring anyone to meet us, whoever she or he, leave them alone, both of you, said my father. There was a pause and some conversation in the background. Then my brother said, Sorry, mate, I was just having a go. I know you think I'm some sort of redneck, but I'm okay with who you are. I'd hate you to get to this age and think I still had a problem with it. So, to add to a momentous day, I corrected a misconception that my family had held for at least 15 years and came out to them as straight. The conversations with Jean, Phil, and my family had been surprisingly therapeutic. I did not need to use the Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale to know that I was feeling sad, but I was back from the edge of the pit. I would need to do some disciplined thinking in the near future to be certain of remaining safe, but for the moment I did not need to shut down the emotional part of my brain entirely. I wanted a little time to observe how I felt about recent events. It was cold and the rain was pouring, but my balcony was under shelter. I took a chair and my glass outside, then went back inside, put on the greasy wool jumper that my mother had knitted for a much earlier birthday, and collected the tequila bottle. I was 40 years old. My father used to play a song written by John Sebastian. I remember that it was by John Sebastian, because Noddy Holder announced prior to singing it, "We're going to do a song by John Sebastian. Are there any John Sebastian fans here?" Apparently there were, because there was loud and raucous applause before he started singing. I decided that tonight I was also a John Sebastian fan, and that I wanted to hear the song. This was the first time in my life that I could recall a desire to hear a particular piece of music. I had the technology, or used to. I went to pull out my mobile phone and realized it had been in the jacket I had discarded. I went inside, booted my laptop, registered for iTunes, and downloaded Darling Be Home Soon from Slade Alive, 1972. I added Satisfaction, thus doubling the size of my popular music collection. I retrieved my earphones from their box and returned to the balcony, poured another tequila, and listened to a voice from my childhood singing that it had taken a quarter of his life before he could begin to see himself. At 18, just before I left home to go to university, statistically approaching a quarter of my life, I had listened to these words and been reminded that I had very little understanding of who I was. It had taken me until tonight, approximately halfway, to see myself reasonably clearly. I had Rosie and the Rosie Project to thank for that. Now it was over, what had I learned? 1. I need not be visibly odd. I could engage in the protocols that others followed and move undetected among them. And how could I be sure that other people were not doing the same, playing the game to be accepted but suspecting all the time that they were different? 2. I had skills that others didn't. My memory and ability to focus had given me an advantage in baseball statistics, cocktail making, and genetics. People had valued these skills, not mocked them. 3. I could enjoy friendship and good times. It was my lack of skills, not lack of motivation, that had held me back. Now I was competent enough socially to open my life to a wider range of people. I could have more friends. Dave the baseball fan could be the first of many. 4. I had told Jean and Claudia that I was incompatible with women. This was an exaggeration. I could enjoy their company, as proven by my joint activities with Rosie and Daphne. Realistically, it was possible that I could have a partnership with a woman. 5. The idea behind the wife project was still sound. In many cultures, a matchmaker would have routinely done what I did, with less technology, reach, and rigor, but the same assumption, that compatibility was as viable a foundation for marriage as love. 6. I was not wired to feel love, and faking it was not acceptable, not to me. I had feared that Rosie would not love me. Instead, it was I who could not love Rosie. 7. I had a great deal of valuable knowledge about genetics, computers, aikido, karate, hardware, chess, wine, cocktails, dancing, sexual positions, social protocols, and the probability of a 56-game hitting streak occurring in the history of baseball. I knew so much shit, and I still couldn't fix myself. As the shuffle setting on my media player selected the same two songs over and over, I realized that my thinking was also beginning to go in circles, and that, despite the tidy formulation, there was some flaw in my logic. I decided it was my unhappiness with the night's outcome breaking through, my wish that it could be different. I watched the rain falling over the city and poured the last of the tequila. Chapter 35. I was still in the chair when I woke the next morning. It was cold and raining and my laptop battery had exhausted itself. I shook my head to test for a hangover, but it seemed that my alcohol processing enzymes had done their job adequately. So had my brain. I had unconsciously set it a problem to solve, and understanding the importance of the situation, it had overcome the handicap of intoxication to reach a solution. I began the second half of my life by making coffee. Then I reviewed the very simple logic. 1. I was wired differently. One of the characteristics of my wiring was that I had difficulty empathizing. This problem has been well documented in others and is, in fact, one of the defining symptoms of the autism spectrum. 2. A lack of empathy would account for my inability to respond emotionally to the situations of fictional characters in films. This was similar to my inability to respond as others did to the victims of the World Trade Center terrorist attacks. But I did feel sorry for Frank, the firefighter guide. And for Daphne, my sister, my parents when my sister died. Carl and Eugenie because of the Jean-Claudia marriage crisis. Jean himself, who wanted to be admired but had achieved the opposite. Claudia, who had agreed to an open marriage but changed her mind and suffered as Jean continued to exploit it. Phil, who had struggled to deal with his wife's infidelity and death and then to win the love of Rosie. Kevin Yu, whose focus on passing the course had blinded him to ethical conduct. The dean, who had to make difficult decisions under contradictory rules and deal with prejudice about her dress and relationship. Faith Healer, who had to reconcile his strong beliefs with scientific evidence. Margaret Case, whose son had committed suicide and whose mind no longer functioned. And, critically, Rosie, whose childhood and now adulthood had been made unhappy by her mother's death and her father problem, and who now wanted me to love her. This was an impressive list, and, though it did not include Rick and Ilsa from Casablanca, it was clear evidence that my empathy capability was not entirely absent. 3. An inability, or reduced ability, to empathize is not the same as an inability to love. Love is a powerful feeling for another person, often defying logic. 4. Rosie had failed numerous criteria on the wife project, including the critical smoking question. My feelings for her could not be explained by logic. I did not care about Meryl Streep, but I was in love with Rosie. I had to act quickly, not because I believed the situation with Rosie was likely to change in the immediate future, but because I needed my jacket, which was, I hoped, still in the rubbish bin where I'd thrown it. Luckily, I was already dressed from the previous evening. It was still raining when I arrived at the bin, just in time to see it emptied into a garbage truck compactor. I had a contingency plan, but it was going to take time. I turned the bike around to head for home across the road. Slumped in a shop doorway, out of the rain, was a hobo. He was fast asleep, and he was wearing my jacket. I carefully reached in the inside pocket and extracted the envelope and my phone. As I remounted my bike, I saw a couple on the other side of the street watching me. The male started to run towards me, but the woman called him back. She was making a call on her mobile phone. It was only 7:48 a.m. when I arrived at the university. A police car approached from the opposite direction, slowed as it passed me, then signaled a U-turn. It occurred to me that it could have been summoned to deal with my apparent theft from the hobo. I turned quickly down the bicycle path, where I could not be followed by a motor vehicle, and headed towards the genetics building to find a towel. As I opened the unlocked door of my office, it was obvious that I had had a visitor, and who that visitor had been. The red roses were lying on my desk. So was the Father Project file, which had been removed from its home in the filing cabinet. The list of father candidate names and sample descriptions was on the desk beside it. Rosie had left a note. Don, I'm sorry about everything. But I know who Table Napkin Man is. I've told Dad. I probably shouldn't have, but I was very upset. I tried to call you. Sorry again, Rosie. There was a lot of crossed-out writing between sorry again and Rosie. But this was a disaster. I needed to warn Jean. His diary indicated a breakfast meeting at the university club. I checked the PhD area, and Stefan was there, but not Rosie. Stefan could see I was highly agitated and followed me. We reached the club and located Jean at a table with the dean. But at another table, I saw Rosie. She was with Claudia and seemed very distressed. I realized that she could be sharing the news about Jean, even prior to a DNA ratification. The father project was ending in total disaster. But I'd come for something else. I was desperate to share my revelation. We could resolve the other problem later. I ran to Rosie's table. I was still wet as a result of forgetting to dry myself. Rosie was obviously surprised to see me. I dispensed with formalities. I've made an incredible mistake. I can't believe I've been so stupid. Irrational. Claudia made signals for me to stop, but I ignored them. You failed almost every criterion of the wife project. Disorganized, mathematically illiterate, ridiculous food requirements. Incredible. I considered sharing my life with a smoker, permanently. Rosie's expression was complex, but appeared to include sadness, anger, and surprise. Didn't take you long to change your mind, she said. Claudia was frantically waving at me to stop, but I was determined to proceed according to my own plan. I haven't changed my mind. That's the point. I want to spend my life with you, even though it's totally irrational, and you have short earlobes. Socially and genetically, there's no reason for me to be attracted to you. The only logical conclusion is that I must be in love with you. Claudia got up and pushed me into a chair. You don't give up, do you? Said Rosie. I'm being annoying. No, said Rosie. You're being incredibly brave. I have the best fun with you. You're the smartest, funniest person I know. You've done all these things for me. It's everything I want, and I've been too scared to grab it because... She stopped, but I knew what she was thinking. I finished her sentence for her. Because I'm weird. Perfectly understandable. I'm familiar with the problem because everyone else seems weird to me. Rosie laughed. I tried to explain. Crying over fictitious characters, for example. Could you live with me crying in movies? Said Rosie. Of course, I said. It's conventional behavior. I stopped as I realized what she had said. You're offering to live with me. Rosie smiled. You left this on the table, she said, and pulled the ring container from her bag. I realized that Rosie had reversed her decision of the previous night and was, in effect, rolling back time to allow my original plan to proceed at an alternative location. I extracted the ring, and she held out her finger. I put it on, and it fitted. I felt a major sense of relief. I became aware of applause. It seemed natural. I'd been living in the world of romantic comedy, and this was the final scene, but it was real. The entire university club dining room had been watching. I decided to complete the story according to tradition and kissed Rosie. It was even better than the previous occasion. You'd better not let me down, said Rosie. I'm expecting constant craziness. Phil walked in, his nose in a plaster cast, accompanied by the club manager. She was followed by two police. The manager pointed Jean out to Phil. Oh, shit, said Rosie. Phil walked over to Jean, who stood up. There was a brief conversation, and then Phil knocked him to the floor with a single punch to the jaw. The police rushed forward and restrained Phil, who did not resist. Claudia ran up to Jean, who was slowly rising. He appeared not to be seriously injured. I realized that under the traditional rules of romantic behavior, it was correct for Phil to assault Jean, assuming he had in fact seduced Rosie's mother when she was Phil's girlfriend. However, it was not certain that Jean was the culprit. On the other hand, numerous men were probably entitled to punch Jean. In this sense, Phil was dispensing romantic justice on their behalf. Jean must have understood because he appeared to be reassuring the police that everything was okay. I redirected my attention to Rosie. Now that my previous plan had been reinstated, it was important not to be distracted. Item 2 on the agenda was your father's identity. Rosie smiled. Back on track. Item one, let's get married. Okay, that's sorted. Item two, this is the Don I've grown to know and love. The last word stopped me. I could only look at Rosie as I took in the reality of what she had said. I guess she was doing the same, and it was several seconds before she spoke. How many positions in that book can you do? The sex book? All of them? Bullshit. It was considerably less complex than the cocktail book. So, let's go home, she said, to my place. Or your place, if you've still got the Atticus Finch outfit, she laughed. It's in my office. Another time. Don't throw it out. We got up, but the police, one man and one woman, blocked our path. Sir, said the woman, age approximately 28, BMI 23. I'm going to have to ask you what's in your pocket. I had forgotten the envelope. I pulled it out and waved it in front of Rosie. Tickets! Tickets to Disneyland! All problems solved! I fanned out the three tickets, took Rosie's hand, and we walked towards Phil to show him. Chapter 36. We went to Disneyland. Rosie, Phil, and I. It was great fun, and appeared to be a success in improving all relationships. Rosie and Phil shared information, and I learned a lot about Rosie's life. It was important background for the difficult but essential task of developing a high level of empathy for one person in the world. Rosie and I were on our way to New York, where being weird is acceptable. That is a simplification of the rationale. In reality, what was important for me was to be able to make a new start with my new skills, new approach, and new partner, without being held back by others' perceptions of me. Perceptions that I'd not only deserved, but encouraged. Here in New York, I'm working in the Department of Genetics at Columbia University, and Rosie is in the first year of the Doctor of Medicine program. I'm contributing to Simon Lefevre's research project remotely, as he insisted on it, as a condition of providing funding. I consider it a form of moral payback for using the university's equipment for the Father Project. We have an apartment in Williamsburg, not far from the Eslers, whom we visit regularly. The cellar interrogation is now a story that Isaac and I both tell on social occasions. We are considering reproducing, or as I would say in a social encounter, having children. In order to prepare for this possibility, Rosie has ceased smoking, and we have reduced our alcohol intake. Fortunately, we have numerous other activities to distract us from these addictive behaviours. Rosie and I work in a cocktail bar together 3 evenings a week. It is exhausting at times, but social and fun, and supplements my academic salary. We listen to music. I have revised my approach to Bach, and am no longer trying to follow individual notes. It is more successful, but my music tastes seem to have been locked in my teens. As a result of failing to make my own selections at that time, my preferences are those of my father. I can advance a well-reasoned argument that nothing worth listening to was recorded after 1972. Rosie and I have that argument frequently. I cook, but reserve the meals of the standardized meal system for dinner parties. We are officially married. Although I had performed the romantic ritual with the ring, I did not expect Rosie, as a modern feminist, to want to actually get married. The term wife in wife project had always meant female life partner. But she decided that she should have one relationship in my life that was what it was supposed to be. That included monogamy and permanence. An excellent outcome. I am able to hug Rosie. This was the issue that caused me the most fear after she agreed to live with me. I generally find body contact unpleasant. But sex is an obvious exception. Sex solved the body contact problem. We're now also able to hug without having sex, which is obviously convenient at times. Once a week, in order to deal with the demands of living with another person and to continue to improve my skills in this sphere, I spend an evening in therapy. This is a small joke. My therapist is Dave, and I provide reciprocal services to him. Dave is also married, and considering that I am supposedly wired differently, our challenges are surprisingly similar. He sometimes brings male friends and colleagues from work, where he is a refrigeration engineer. We're all Yankees fans. For some time, Rosie did not mention the father project. I attributed this to the improved relationship with Phil and the distraction of other activities. But in the background, I was processing some new information. At the wedding, Dr. Eamon Hughes, the first person we had tested, asked to speak to me privately. "There's something you should know," he said, "about Rosie's father." It seemed entirely plausible that Rosie's mother's closest friend from medical school would know the answer. Perhaps we had only needed to ask. But Eamon was referring to something else. He pointed to Phil. "Phil's been a bit of a screw-up with Rosie." So it wasn't only Rosie who thought Phil was a poor parent. "You know about the car accident?" I nodded, although I had no detailed information. Rosie had made it clear that she did not want to discuss it. Bernadette was driving because Phil had been drinking. I had deduced that Phil was in the car. Phil got out with a broken pelvis and pulled Rosie out. Eamon paused. He was obviously distressed. He pulled Rosie out first. This was truly an awful scenario. But as a geneticist, my immediate thought was, of course, Phil's behaviour, in pain and under extreme pressure, would surely have been instinctual. Such life and death situations occur regularly in the animal kingdom, and Phil's choice was in line with theory and experimental results. While he had presumably revisited that moment many times in his mind, and his later feelings towards Rosie may have been severely affected by it, his actions were consistent with the primitive drive to protect the carrier of his genes. It was only later that I realized my obvious error. As Rosie was not Phil's biological daughter, such instincts would not have been applicable. I spent some time reflecting on the possible explanations for his behavior. I did not share my thoughts or the hypothesis I formed. When I was established at Columbia, I requested permission to use the DNA testing facilities for a private investigation. They were willing to let me do so. It would not have been a problem if they had refused. I could have sent my remaining samples to a commercial laboratory and paid a few hundred dollars for the tests. This option had been available to Rosie from the beginning of the Father Project. It is now obvious to me that I did not alert Rosie to that option because I was subconsciously interested in a relationship with her, even then. Amazing. I did not tell Rosie about the test. One day I just packed my bag with the samples that I'd brought with me to New York. I started with the paranoid plastic surgeon, Freiberg, who was the least likely candidate in my assessment. A green-eyed father was not impossible, but there was no other evidence making him more probable than any of the previous candidates. His reluctance to send me a blood sample was explained by him being a generally suspicious and unhelpful person. My prediction was correct. I loaded Esler's specimen, a swab from a fork that had travelled more than halfway around the world and back again. In his darkened basement, I had been certain he was Rosie's father. But afterwards, I'd come to the conclusion that he could have been protecting a friend or the memory of a friend. I wondered if Esler's decision to become a psychiatrist had been influenced by the suicide of the best man at his wedding, Jeffrey Case. I tested the sample. Isaac Esler was not Rosie's father. I picked up Jean's sample, my best friend. He was working hard on his marriage. The map was no longer on his wall when I went in to submit my resignation to the dean. But I had no recollection of seeing a pin in Ireland, Rosie's mother's birthplace. There was no need to test the table napkin. I tossed it in the waste bin. I had now eliminated every candidate except Jeffrey Case. Isaac Esler had told me that he knew who Rosie's father was and that he was sworn to secrecy. Did Rosie's mother and Esler not want Rosie to know that there was a family history of suicide? Or perhaps a genetic predisposition to mental illness? Or that Jeffrey Case had possibly killed himself in the wake of the news that he was Rosie's father and that her mother had decided to remain with Phil? These were all good reasons. Good enough that I considered it highly likely that Rosie's mother's one-night encounter had been with Jeffrey Case. I reached into my bag and pulled out the DNA sample that fate had delivered to me without Rosie's knowledge. I was now almost certain that it would confirm my hypothesis as to her paternity. I cut a small portion of the cloth, poured over the reagent, and let it sit for a few minutes. As I watched the fabric in the clear solution and mentally reviewed the father project, I became more and more confident in my prediction. I decided that Rosie should join me for this result, regardless of whether I was right or wrong. I texted her. She was on campus and arrived a few minutes later. She immediately realized what I was doing. I put the processed sample in the machine and waited while the analysis proceeded. We watched the computer screen together until the result came up. After all the blood collecting, cheek swabbing, cocktail shaking, wall climbing, glass collecting, flying, driving, proposal writing, urine mopping, cup stealing, fork wiping, tissue retrieving, toothbrush stealing, hairbrush cleaning, and tear wiping, we had a match. Rosie had wanted to know who her biological father was. Her mother had wanted the identity of the man she had sex with, perhaps only once, on an occasion of emotion-driven rule-breaking, to remain a secret forever. I could now fulfill both of their wishes. I showed her the remains of the blood-stained singlet from Jarman's gym, with the sample square cut out of it. There would be no need to test the handkerchief that had wiped Margaret Case's tears. Ultimately, the entire father problem was caused by Jean. He almost certainly taught the medical students an oversimplified model of the inheritance of common traits. If Rosie's mother had known that eye color was not a reliable indicator of paternity and organized a DNA test to confirm her suspicions, there would have been no father project, no great cocktail night, no New York adventure, no reform Don project, and no Rosie project. Had it not been for this unscheduled series of events, her daughter and I would not have fallen in love. And I would still be eating lobster every Tuesday night. Incredible.
The Rosie Project was written by Graham Simsion and read by Dan O'Grady. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Van Rimmelauer. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Rosie Project is also available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.